Grief is the cost of loving. And Tri and many more of you who have suffered great loss in recent past will share some of our experiences, and then Granger will comment on it, and we'll open it up for discussion. Elmer asked that I be first. There was a prince in a far-off land whose position was being compromised by revolutionaries who were out to kill him so they could take his kingdom. He sought refuge in a peasant's home. The peasant hid him under a very heavy old bed. The revolutionaries came into the peasant's house. The bed was too hard to move, so they poked swords into the bed and then left. And then the prince came out and then revealed his identity to the peasant and was very grateful, of course, to the peasant and told him that he would grant him 3 wishes. The first one was that his house was in disrepair and he'd like to have it fixed up. And the prince says, "You stupid fellow, to ask for something so simple, but that shall be done." And the next request was, "I sell my wares down the street, and there is another person selling the same kind of wares right next to me. Couldn't we have a different location for one or the other?" He says, "You idiot, to ask for such a simple thing, but it will be granted. What is your third request?" He said, "I would like to know how you felt when you were under that bed." And he says, he was very incensed, and he says, "How dare you ask Majesty emotional questions? For that you shall be beheaded at dawn." And so the prince ordered people to carry him off to the jail to await his beheading in the morning. He, of course, grieved and was in great misery all night. At dawn the next morning, they took him out. The executioner was there in his black hat. And he put his head on the block and called 1, 2. And just before he was to holler, call 3, another soldier came rushing in on his horse and says, "Stop in the name of the prince." And so he saved his life. And of course, the fellow was very relieved, and he says, "The prince also gives you this message." And he opened it up and read it, and he says, "Now I have answered your third question. You see, this kind of experience can't be really explained in words. Without having experienced it, you can't really address it." We've experienced what Harriet Sarnoff Schiff refers to as the ultimate tragedy. Karen, who died just before she was to come back from 2 years in Cameroon as a volunteer, where she taught in a mission school a number of subjects. Her application blank was interesting. Completed, "I feel that as a Christian I should live simply so that I can more easily identify with the poor and the oppressed. Volunteer service is a perfect means to do this, as I will be earning no money to give a false sense of security. I'm encouraged in the fellowship of others, and I feel a strong call to align myself with the disenfranchised." She became one of them, as revealed by her colleagues. "We African professors who have enjoyed the friendship and the cooperation without crack, without fault, of our colleague and friend have cried with hot tears. As many of you know, this young woman identified herself with us blacks. Her insight and sensitivity to those whom she worked with is revealed in the following. I've been thinking about life and death all day today. One of my students died yesterday after a very short, strange illness. He was one of the intelligent troublemakers as opposed to the stupid troublemakers in his class last year. I was thinking today that I'm sure he's a student I had the most physical contact with last year. I was always pushing him back to his desk and holding him there. And we had verbal battles every day. Sit down, Mabala. Be quiet, Mabala. Where is your homework? Oh, why didn't you do it? And ad infinitum, repetium, ad nauseum. I've been feeling so sad ever since he died. And my cheeks are beginning to get chapped from the tears. The kids were subdued today, and the teachers who taught him last year, not one had a smile on his face all day. 14 years old is too young to die. I remember a theme he wrote for me last year about the last time he'd been to his village. I remember crying as I read it because they were so happy to see him. And then after the holiday was over, his father cried to see him go, and so did his mother and all his brothers and sisters. And Mabala cried too because he loved them, and school was so far away from them. The theme was so sensitive and simple, so much at variance with his behavior in the classroom, that I couldn't help but ponder over it a bit. Well, we're all crying again at this newest and longer separation. As I was walking home from school today, basking in the sunshine, I couldn't help crying out to God how terrible it was that Mabala would never feel the sunshine on his cheeks again. There's nothing like death right in front of you, almost to make you receptive to really listening. Maybe that's why sometimes life in America gets so trivial and banal, because we aren't so close to death the way we are here. So we can ignore questions that concern the meaning of life and death. I've been thinking of staying another year, but I'm not sure now. Kids are always dying here, and I can't bear to go through it again. Almost every year a student dies at college. Last year it was a student I didn't know, so it didn't hit me. Now I know almost all of them, and I want to think of them all as having bright futures here on earth. I don't want to mourn anymore. I'd rather go home where death is hidden away and the people who die are strangers in the newspaper. I came here to broaden my outlook. First, my kitten died. One morning he's lively and supple and warm in my hands. And when I came home from school, I picked him up all cold and stiff and hard with ants eating his eyes. That was hard for me. I've had pets die before, but I've never held them in my arms and thrown them down the garbage hole. And now to have Mabala die. The news came to me on my way to a national convention where I had 3 or 4 speeches to give. There's a call from our son. And I had always given a lot of advice. I had counseled many grieving as dean of a college. But I had always given advice, you got to carry on. So I had to take my own advice, even though everything was ashes. I went through with part of it, and then I went home to comfort and be comforted by my family and to get ready for an international congress and then a trip to New Zealand and Australia. I had, as I said, lectured on grief and counseled many people on grief. But I started really to go down the tubes. I started losing weight. I wasn't sleeping very much. I wasn't eating because it also was ashes. By the time I got to an international conference, I wasn't sure if I could walk a block. As you've already heard from Granger, any separation is very devastating. It will reduce your resistance to disease. The accident rate is much higher, and the death rate is much higher. But I got a hold of myself and said, I can't carry on like this. I have to start thinking about those who I still have. And since this, I was nursing my own grief. One cannot cure one's own grief by nursing it. Only by nursing other people's grief can one heal one's own grief? And you see, I'm now legitimate. And I have been, I think, effective, and many people, I think, have been helped by talking to me and others who have experienced such great grief, because we made it so far. And when you, in the first stages of this, you're not sure that you're going to make it. And so, on many occasions, I have publicly and privately discussed this, because I remember a conversation, one of three I've had with Paul Tournier. My first one was in 1970. And I talked about this, and he says, it is very important that you articulate your grief. I had asked him a question, I won't go into it now. It was the only question that he didn't give me a quick answer. He thought about it for a while, and he says, well, you must articulate your grief. I'm going to come back to him in a minute. I'm going to close. I'd like to close with something Karin wrote on her white robe, so we'll postpone that. Now continue with Paul Tournier. I was privileged again. Well, in 1971, Karin and Becky and my wife and I visited again with Paul Tournier, and this time with his wife. And Karin spoke French to him, and he remembered that. I was going to be in Geneva again this last October, so I wrote to him and told him I was coming. Tournier is now 85, and he drove into town to come and have dinner with me. I'd sent him the material on Karin, and he was a very great comfort to me. And as were many, many people, those who had suffered such loss were, of course, the most help. And we were deluged by much help, by many books, which we can share at the end here. But I asked Paul Tournier, and this introduces the other speakers, if he thought about his wife every day. For you must understand that it seems that those who are gone seem to invade the mind the more. But the ache and the emptiness is there, for we are so fiercely tied to the touch of a hand, a gleam in the eye, and a sound of a voice. And it's almost overwhelming, as my associates and many of you can profess. Every day you're sad. And you do a lot of crying, even 11 months out. But you have to, every event has a cloud. Every sunshiny day has a cloud. But we have to concentrate on the happy occasions and the sunshine. Well, Paul Tournier, to my question when I asked him, you know, does he think of his wife every day? He didn't answer me directly. He says, well, she's with me in everything I do. Now, she's been dead for 8 years. And he said, Not as she was then, but as she is now, because it's a continuing thing. And I thought that was very beautiful. And he was one of five men who hugged me. A lot of women hugged me, but only five men. Gertrude.
I hope I can bear up in talking to you. Some of you don't know that Beanie was connected with the village for 20, would have been the 21st year. And so Holden Village is very much a part of him and of my life as well. He died 2 months ago and was intending to come out here this summer. I know many of you have gone through this same experience, and it's not new to you to talk about grief, nor to know what it's like. So what I have to say is nothing new to you, really, except that Holden is providing a place to share it, again and again, and that I know is healing. We've learned here at Holden that instead of keeping your mouth closed and not talking about it is not healing. And so when I decided to come out here, I had lots of affirmation from board members, at least 3 calls from Elmer, some from John Schramm, that I must come back. And it would have been hard any place, but I knew what a healing place Holden is and has been to many people through the years. And while it's hard for me to be here, it's also very reassuring that the comfort is here. One of the things I learned while I was going through this, that tears of grief are different than any tears of bitterness or anger. They have tested this and find out their different content. And that was, to me, was very interesting and a good sign that it's good to cry and I can do it freely, and especially with those who encourage me to talk and they share the grief with me. I also experienced the death with Elmer, and I think just having gone through Ginny's death helped me to go through mine. We kept in contact with Elmer almost every week after he found out that Ginny would not be here. And having those conversations every week by phone with Ginny was very strengthening to me, and to know what faith and courage was, not knowing I was going to experience the same thing so soon. I had been up for Ginny's funeral on Saturday, and on the next Thursday, Elmer and Paul came through town, and I invited them to please stop, and if they felt they could, to stop and have a meal with us, because my husband wasn't able to go. He was not even ill at that time, but he doesn't hear well, and he knew he wouldn't hear the service and so forth. So Elmer joined us and Paul, and we had dinner together, and Elmer got to tell his story to my husband personally. And the following Monday, Beanie got sick and was never conscious after that. I went through the whole experience of quick death. He lived for 2 weeks, and I learned what life support means and how awful that can be, as well as good. It was a cerebral hemorrhage that Beanie had, and he became unconscious right away, and they did brain surgery for massive bleeding. He was never conscious after that. But they did a coma, put him in a coma to relieve pressure on the brain and the rest of the body, and this is why it took long. I'm sure he would have died within a day or two otherwise. That was a hard process for me because it took 4 days to administer, 4 days to taper off. Then the weekend came and substitute doctors wouldn't touch it legally. I wanted to terminate it right then because I knew he was not going to make it. Those were very hard days because he was in a, he couldn't move at all on his own. He was in a rocking bed, which went constantly like this, very slowly, but it meant I couldn't ever sit with him and really feel like I was near to him. We could hold his hand for a few minutes, then he had to dance around the bed, you know, and that was certainly not very satisfying. We tried all kinds of things to reach him, especially music, since that's been his line of work. And Jeff Cohan, who's been here many times, came up and played. I asked the doctors if that would be okay, and he said, please do it, it would be good. So he came up and played a half an hour flute concert for him. We saw no response at that time, but at least we hoped maybe he heard it. It would be a different pitch level. I felt all the time that we were prolonging his death rather than prolonging his life. And so when they wanted to repeat the process after the 14th day, I said, please no. And the doctor took a good long look at me and he said, but he's not dying. And I said, I want to let him die. And he got a big smile on his face and said, okay. And 3 other doctors came in to reassure me that that was the good thing to do. I had one afternoon when I got to sit with him in a regular bed where we could hold his hand and talk. And we also put on tapes on his earphones in his ears to see if he could hear music in that way. And it was the only time we saw his eyeballs move at all. And so we hoped something penetrated that he did hear it. At that time, we played, knew he was going to die, and we played Come Sweet Death, In Faith I Calmly Rest. And I hope that's what he wanted to hear at the end. To me, death came as a gift. And the nurses thought I was very strong at the time, and I said, I knew he couldn't live and be as he would want to live. For his sake, it was a gift that he could die. And I almost clapped my hands, just as we did at Jenny's celebration. You know, Elmer said to me she was here, and I said, yeah. She had talked about her service and said, it's going to be so great, I wish I could be there. And she told me through this over the phone and also had told him, and he had a tape of it and all. But when she told me this over the phone, I just thought it was wonderful. And at the service, I just thought, Jenny's up there clapping her hands and say, didn't I tell you so? It was so great. And our service was similarly, it was a musical kind of service because that's what he was in. And we had lots of songs and praise and thankfulness for the life he'd given. And I'm just grateful for 38 years of marriage to this man. And I live with those memories and the ones here. And grateful to all these people who are supportive here. I have sat in on his sessions on death and dying, and Al Rognes is with him. Fritz Norstedt was here, and he had just lost a daughter who was 26, and his whole Sunday vesper was going through this death story of Susan, and we all cried with him. And that helps. I mean, if you cry, it helps us cry, and that's good for all of us. So if these stories help you, that's okay, and it makes me feel better, too. It is necessary to tell the story over and over and over again, and I thank you for allowing me to do that. I've also known Granger and have had his book for years. I think I have one of his first copies. And we have a chaplain's, we have a befriender service at our church, a hospice unit that he's been instrumental in partly. And I've taken all those courses thinking, well, when death comes, you can handle it. And you find out you're not any different than anybody else, you know. It hits you, and I hope I'm going through the grief process right, and maybe not getting angry. I'm certainly not angry at God. I'm just grateful to him for the life we had and the life of service that he had. And hope I can carry on and help others that I have not maybe helped before.
Right on schedule.
I'm a confirmed griever. I cried about an hour and a half ago. I got out the book that I wrote in sitting next to Ginny's bed while she died just about 4 months ago. And I thought maybe I'd read something to you, but I can't. I just sat and cried. The difference between the three of us, the glaring difference is that Ginny came home from the hospital nine weeks, before she died and knew that she came home to die, chose to come home to die. And so, in some sense at least, she helped us in the grieving process. And that's a real gift. Beforehand, when we found out in that following gallbladder operation that she was that she had widespread cancer, which that's the direct quote from the little scrawny Jewish surgeon whom I talked to twice before in my life, but who took me in a little room to give me the worst news I had ever received. My response to him was, she's a woman of faith, doc. And when I finally told Ginny the results of the operation, her first words, after only a brief pause, was, I can live with that. Before, once she knew that she was going to die, the whole world changed for her. I don't know what all went inside of her. I can just tell you some of the things we saw, and I won't go into those. That's not the point of the evening. Except that one good process was getting rid of all of her worldly goods. She went upstairs with the girls and went through her closet and gave everything away. There was nothing in her closet for weeks before she died. And there was something that happened in that process too. I don't fully understand that, but it seemed to me it was important. She talked to many people on the phone, indeed Gertrude as one of them. And that contact with people that she had known over the years was, again, another part of it. For Ginny, cancer, and this is, I think all of us say, what one experiences, the way of death and the way of grieving, is not going to be the same in details as anybody else's. But for Ginny, cancer was a snap. And she said so. For she had been in depression years before, had been hospitalized a couple of times. She talked freely about this and had even had shock treatment. And all during that, she often prayed, told me she had prayed for a physical illness. For during depression, everybody was distant. And it was only she felt she was the one that was wrong. And so she distanced herself. And it went down and down and down until with good care that was turned around. And so she didn't cry or get depressed during any of the days. She was sad about separation, deeply so, cried about that, but never was depressed. Told the doc, "I've been through it, doc. Compared to that, this is a snap. The hundreds of letters and phone calls and the attention," she said, "I've never had this much attention in my life." She lived into it. Her faith took changes. In some senses, her faith became more ethereal. In some senses, more earthy. Her life revolved around water. She talked about water. She responded to water. Part of it was obviously because she was not getting any food. Since she died March 8th, she hadn't really had a meal since December 25th. And had only taken IVs, and then only occasionally, and finally not at all. But she dreamed of water. She talked about water. We had a picture of Greece on the wall where she and I had swam together in the water. And the water of baptism, the water of Al Swihart, who used to set up the sprinklers here and put them in front of our chalet, so when she came out, she had to walk through the water. 10 Mile Creek Falls, down here. All kinds of water was very important to her. And I have no doubt that she swam into heaven. And it was tied to things beyond that. There was a coming together for her of matter and spirit and earth. She loved her body. She would not wear a nightgown in her last weeks. She didn't want to be, she wanted to be free. And for freedom for her meant to be able to move her arms and not be tied down to any clothes. Her body was terribly important to her. She wanted to be massaged. And all of that fit together, not separate from the faith. Don't pretend to understand what happened during those days. But that was her ministry to us. She talked to many people. Martin Marty and Joseph Sittler came to visit her at length. As Joe told me, he said, I need her. I come out as often as I can to learn from her. And they talked about death, and they talked about why people get cancer or any evil happens. And they nourished one another. That was an important dimension of her preparation. Again, and shared that with anybody who came. She wasn't willing to come and let them talk about the flowers or whatever else. She wanted to talk about what it meant to her to die and what it may mean to others as we all face it. I don't think I've talked about this publicly before. The moment of death was tough. She was not in deep pain except for 45 minutes before she died, when she struggled to breathe. And that gasping just drove all of us around the bed, all except son Paul was there, drove us mad, desperate, And then it stopped. And then the last 10 minutes or so, she breathed easily. And then it slowed down. And then she missed a breath and took one more and stopped. Of the 9 weeks, those 10 minutes are absolutely the focus of my memory. I don't know why. I don't relish those. Those weren't the best ones. We had laughed a lot, cried a lot, and loved a lot, and hugged a lot in those 9 weeks. But those 10 minutes are still it. And I think that's part of my grieving. Afterwards, before, the home care that we received, the home care nurse, the hospice help, was just excellent. The nurses spent as much time or more with us as family than they spent with Jenny. They knew, I think, wisely, that she was in better shape than we were. And so they spent time talking to us. The home nurse's first call, not knowing us at all, asked me if I knew a clergyman. I told her I thought I knew a few. But her concern for the church and the religious dimension to be brought in at the outset was just reassuring and refreshing to us. And that care of helping us even to be ready for the moment of her departure was very, very helpful. We had good care. And I'm still in touch with those home care nurses a little bit to this moment. Afterwards is when we really needed each other. That part of it, the words she said to each one of us, the things, the quote I had the other night about that I should be careful with Holden, and many other things that she said that I read again tonight and cried about, those things last so much. And then the touch of all the people, as Gertrude said, and especially of us who shared that together. It's a little tough to be absent from the people who went through it together. When we were all together again this weekend, that was good and difficult. It was an emotional day for me Sunday to be installed. It was a deeper emotional day because I had the 5 kids who had spent most of those 7 weeks, 9 weeks with Ginny together. And that's tough. We rely deeply on one another now, but I have to end by saying, if you're going to grieve, man, is Holden a good place to do it. The supportive community, the close friends, the intimate friends that I have here, and praise God, the discipline of the worship life has given me stuff that I didn't dream would be possible. I still go back. I know Kubler-Ross has 5 and Granger has 10. Kubler, by the way, was Jenny's therapist at one time, and she has written since I've been here. I probably got 20, I think, but I go back to him. I still wake up or dream during the day that I'm still on the trip, and this is still, I'm going back to Madison, and Jenny will be there, and it'll all go away. I still do some denying of it, I know. I bump into her every day. Sometimes it's fun, and sometimes it's really sad. But this is a neat place, and the people are still the thing that keep me going. I'm grateful for that. And they're the reminders of the hope that I have. And I guess the inching towards the reality of not only her death, but the naturalness of death itself. I just don't like the timing. It was natural.
Well, have any of you ever sat in on a discussion like this before? One or two? Have any of you had anything like this in your church? Following a funeral or at a later date? 1, 2, 3. Do you think that this is what ought to happen in the communities of faith? where people can talk about it in this way. We've had three people who are unusually articulate, unusually strong in the midst of this 4 months of
two
months and less than just a year. I know we are all helped by this. Now the question is, should the community of faith do more along the lines of helping people? When Elmer says one of the best place to grieve is in Holden, would you say the best place to grieve is among the people of your parish church? Do you feel close to them? Do you have this kind of relationship? Most of us are strangers, I suppose. Some of us know each other, and some of us we've met this week and feel that we know you better in 7 days than we know some of the members of our church in 7 years. What can we do in our churches to help the healing process, to help the ministry of caring, which is what the church is supposed to be all about? Well, that's how I feel, and I would just like to let you now come at it in any way that you like, and I'm sure they wouldn't mind if you asked certain questions of any type, so that we could think about this. And I would like to hope that during the next year, when you go back to your communities, that you will sit down with a pastor and say, I sat in on an evening with three people who were recently bereaved, and it was a great evening. Couldn't we do something like that for the people in our parish who are going through similar times? Or do we just have the funeral and then forget all about it and try to say good things the next time? I just think that next year when we come back, if some of you could say, well, what we did in our church was, and then you would describe what you've done in your church. I presume it'll be easier to do this in a small church than in a very large church. And it would have to be done with care, with careful selection of the people, perhaps, who would come, a careful selection of the room in which it would be held, certainly the roundness of this room, the centralness of the ability of all of us to see each other is very, very important. But think about it, care about it, and maybe something can happen in your church. Now, what are some of your comments, reflections, questions?
Have you talked about befrienders groups that are in the church?
Tell them about your befrienders group. I think it's a real asset to your congregation.
Our chaplain, he's from the Lutheran Hospital, but also goes to the various churches, and we have at least 6 months training. It's longer than that, because I haven't even been able to take it because I haven't stayed home a whole year. But it's intense training on visiting in the hospital and with grief. People in grief particularly, they go visit the hospital, they come back and tell the experiences. You know, some people don't want them to come in and talk. And first they just go in to talk with them and visit and are primarily a listener. And it's been so successful that all the churches around there are doing the same thing. And I experienced this in the hospital. And they don't just come to, that it's finished there. It's follow-up. They see how you're doing at home afterwards. How you're relating to family, if people are still visiting you and contacting you. It's very exciting, and we find it one of the strengths of the hospital. And I think it carries on over to the staff even and to the doctors that are there. The woman that came down to put in this rocking bed was from the Iowa University Clinic at our, and I was surprised to see that she was back, still there 2 days later. I mean, she stayed and was sure that every shift of nurses stayed there and watched how to operate that thing. When they changed the diet even of intravenous feeding and added another protein supplement, she was right there because it had to be measured so strictly on that bed, and which just moved all the time. And I questioned her about her being there, and she said, well, I want to be sure everybody knows what to do and the right thing to do. And before she left, she came back in to talk to me, and she said, I want to tell you I service a radius of hospitals in all the Tri-Cities, which is Davenport, Rock Island, if you know that area in the Midwest, Moline, Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, Rockford, Illinois. That's quite a big area. And she said, this is the finest hospital and the finest staff of nurses I've come across anywhere. They're the most caring, which was very reassuring to me at that point to know I'm having it personally, you know, for him in this kind of bed. And that kind of reassurance to the staff means so much, and they respond to you. And I couldn't say enough about what the hospital did. I mean, they were in night after night to say, how are you doing? You know, they brought in the thermoses of coffee and juice at like 3 o'clock in the morning. How are you? Because we stayed there night and day for 10 days and didn't go home except to shower and have a bite to eat. That kind of concern, as well as our church community, was just as loyal. But that befriend group is just an outstanding service, I think.
As a designer of churches, I have been confronted lately by a phenomenon which is comparable to what the cry room used to be for mothers who took their babies out. And since my father's death last month, it's become more and more of a kind of an insult to me to have to even contend with this particular problem, but I appreciate you sharing any thoughts about it. An inordinately large number of new churches are designing facilities so that the bereaved can attend services in separate rooms and can view the whole thing unseen by the rest of the congregation. It is a cry room for the bereaved. Now, I guess if when you talk about what can your congregation do, any congregation, it seems to me, that is insulted by the messiness of grief is not going to feel very adequately equipped to sit in a circle and talk with one another.
I would guess that they took this from funeral parlors, which have been doing this for 30, 40 years, isolating people who don't even feel that they're related to this whole experience.
We're working with churches, for example, on a very minimal budget that are insisting on that particular little phenomenon, and so I read it as a kind of a sign of our time, and it's a rather frightening one to me.
Well, I think we have to take a page out of Africa. We faced had to make a rapid decision of what we do with Karn, because the decision has to be made within 2 days. Do you take Karn home or do you bury her there? We made the wise decision that we buried her there. We paid great compliment to the Africans that we left her there. And in the mind of the African, at least in the area where she was, the body and the spirit becomes part of them and part of their soil, and where she is buried is hallowed ground forever. And even as of last week, when we got a letter from Andy Hinderley, the flowers still appear on her grave. But what I'm going back to here, Rich, is that as soon as she died, the locals all assembled, and they did an all-night vigil and sang the songs and talked about her. And then the funeral the next day, everybody showed up, even at the periphery were the Muslims who she had befriended, and the various faiths. They couldn't accommodate them all. And they're all in it together, community, and don't mind crying out in public. So I think we have a lot to learn from them, and when she went there, she went with the idea that she would learn more from them than what she could teach them, which is a bit unusual for Americans going to other countries to help.
One of the comments about Karen was that she was ill and became so thin, and Leo thought she should go to England or go up to a doctor and get some real good help. She wouldn't hear of that. She'd so identified with the people. She said they don't have a chance to do that. She chose to do what they do.
It was not an option for her students, so it couldn't be an option for her. She died suddenly. She had had anemic dysentery, but was at least told me she was gaining weight again. But she was joking about having dry heaves and dysentery again the night before when she was out with some of the folks. And she probably went into electrolyte imbalance, cardiac arrhythmia, and cardiac arrest, at least in the view of her brother, who's a cardiologist. There's another burning question that comes up in this that I think we should address. And hopefully it's helpful to you, because under circumstances like this, say, well, it was God's will that they die. And one of the things that really helped me was books that people sent me, and one of my former students sent me Weatherhead's The Will of God, which is available in a library. He says, the matter came to me most poignantly when I was in India. I was standing on the veranda of an Indian home darkened by bereavement. My Indian friend had lost his little son, the light of his eyes, in a cholera epidemic. At the far end of the veranda, his little daughter, the only remaining child, slept in a cot covered over with a mosquito net. We paced up and down, and I tried in my clumsy way to comfort and console him. But he said, well, Padre, it is the will of God. That's all there is to it. It is the will of God. Fortunately, I knew him well enough to be able to reply without being misunderstood, and I said something like this. Supposing someone crept up the steps onto the veranda tonight while you slept and deliberately put a wad of cotton soaked in cholera germ culture over your little girl's mouth as she lay in the cot there, what would you think about that? My God, he said, what would I think of that? Nobody would do such a damnable thing. If he attempted it, I caught him, I would kill him with as little compunction as I would a snake and throw him over the veranda. What do you mean by suggesting such a thing? But John, I said quietly, isn't that just what you've accused God of doing when you said it was his will? Call your little boy's death the result of a mass ignorance. Call it mass folly. Call it mass sin, if you like. Call it bad drains or communal carelessness. But don't call it the will of God. Surely we cannot identify as the will of God something for which a man would be locked up in jail or put in a criminal lunatic asylum. Those who want a text for this sermon will find it in the 18th chapter of St. Matthew's Gospel, in the 14th verse. It is not the will of your Father which is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. We are most fortunate, those of us who have spoken. Jean sitting there, and Jenny's folks, who's Jenny's corner, and many others. I'm reminded of a story out of Korea. A missionary had been there for many years, and his wife became ill and was dying. He was sobbing, and she said, "Don't cry for me, for you will get me back." She died, and not long after, their only son became sick unto death, and he was trying to comfort his son. The son was trying to comfort him, and his father was crying, and the son said, "But you will get me back." And at the funeral, of course, many Koreans showed up, and one Korean woman was crying, and her friend said, "Why are you crying?" She says, "I'm crying because this man has lost his son." She says, "You should not cry for him. You should cry for me, who has lost a daughter, and you, who has lost a son, because we will never see them again. But these people, these missionaries, they have a way of getting their dead back again." And this brings me to a final note for me. And it is one of the last letters that Corin wrote. "Speaking of a dream, I had a strange one the other night. I was at a village market and saw a man holding up some clothes for sale. the long white robes that men wear here. All of a sudden I felt such a longing, a deep craving for a white robe like that. The sun was hitting the robe so that it shone brilliantly white, almost blinding me with the reflection it was giving off the sun. And I went stumbling up to the man asking how much it was. I was sure that if I could wear a robe like that, so white, whiter than snow, I would somehow be closer to God. But then I realized that wearing a white robe wouldn't do the trick, that it had to go deeper than that. And in a way, when I turned away from the man and left the robe there, I was disappointed. It would be much easier to wear a white robe, wouldn't it, than to have a pure heart. I'll never forget that dream. It was so vivid. We live in the assurance and the great hope that she is now wearing a white robe. When she left us 3 years ago, and we said goodbye, on the way home, I broke into uncontrollable sobbing. Because I thought I would never see her again. And I told my wife, after I got control of myself, that we could have stopped her from going to the Cameroon by just not teaching her about Jesus when she was young. But if we had it to do again, we'd do it the same.
Amen. Maybe that's the time to say good night. Thank you all very much.
Why don't you read this poem? Yeah. She mentioned, there is one thing you should hear. Because you mentioned the healing tears.
I don't know if I can do it.
And here's the first verse, and here's the other, because they're not clear.
Not this one?
No. It's the same one. You read that, and then you read that and that, because that's clearer than that, okay? Yes. So it's those three. And this was found in Karen's material by Jim Naas after her death. It was found in her apartment.
God gave you tears. Weep your tears. Suppressed grief builds a dam, but spilled it flows as a cleansing stream. Grief is a channel that appears. Weep your tears. Our eyes release the misery the heart would store. They see the heaven's veiled door. Death's victim win victory. Weep your tears. The loss leaves lesser pain when faith reveals your loved one's gain. Let peace dissolve all fears. Weep your tears.